You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Steelworkers District 11 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. United Steelworkers District 11 represents 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. And Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in Western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum in their commitment to giving working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And we thank our underwriters for their support to KKFI and the Heartland Labor Forum. On tonight's show, we'll ask economist Richard Wolff how the economy is doing and is it blowing bubbles. Then, railway workers belong to a bunch of different unions, and their disunity costs them at the bargaining table. Now there's a movement from rank and filers to coordinate. We'll talk to some of them. In the news, the migrant caravan. Why do they come? And our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. We're going to talk about the upcoming elections. Big surprise. Now for the news. Now for the news from our side, October 25th, 2018. I'm Judy Ansel, and we're doing something different this week on the news. It's an editorial which I wrote and submitted to the Kansas City Star. I wrote it because I'm president of the local nonprofit called the Cross Border Network, and I've been to Honduras on human rights delegations five times since 2009. The Star said they're really backed up with election op-eds, so we're going to read it here and possibly look for other outlets. It's called No One Is Asking Why They Come, and I'll be reading it along with Michael Savoir. As the November elections approach, so does the caravan of thousands of desperate Hondurans trudging through Mexico. Meanwhile, Donald Trump gets political mileage by inciting fear of criminals and unknown Middle Easterners among them. Reporters on the ground, of course, know Trump's rants are pure demagoguery. They tell us that half the caravan is women and children. Videos and photos show poor people carrying babies, small backpacks, and little else. As Americans, we glorify the courage of the pilgrims who braved the North Atlantic or the pioneers who trekked west. These days, we prefer our dangerous journeys to be by video game, while Trump insults and criminalizes the 21st century version of our migrant ancestors. Think about what would lead you to leave the U.S. on foot, only a few dollars in your pocket, plastic shoes on your feet, and a toddler in tow, passing through territory of savage gangs for a destination 1,400 miles away, where you might be turned away or imprisoned. You'd have to be desperate to attempt such a journey. Why is no one asking why they come? Let me start with a few personal stories of Hondurans I know and then go to the politics behind them. My friend Irena's son came here because her town has been poisoned by a Canadian mining company. It's a cancer cluster, and local officials were bought off. Irena and her son joined a protest group, and the police began threatening and harassing him. So she sent him to safety in the U.S. My friend Ramiro lives here with his wife and child. He's documented, but his sister's ex-husband bribed a local official in his hometown to steal the family's house and land. The local authorities are intimidated, and each time Ramiro goes back for court dates, he risks his life.
When the Honduran military killed indigenous leader Tomas Garcia in protest against the theft of the river, which sustains life for his people, they shot Thomas's son in the stomach. People rushed him to the hospital. One of our members was there, and they asked her to go buy the medicine and the surgical supplies to save the boy because the healthcare system was looted by President Juan Orlando Hernandez for his election campaign. My organization has investigated two separate incidents where six innocent indigenous and Afro-indigenous people were murdered by the Honduran police, military, and USDEA officials in botched drug raids. Two friends who were university students dream of coming here to finish their education because the universities are frequently closed. The building was falling apart with no labs or supplies. The list goes on. So what's behind it? The current Honduran crisis began in 2009 with a coup approved by Obama's administration. Last year, Trump recognized the fraudulent and unconstitutional election and said nothing when U.S.-trained military and police used live ammunition to shoot protesters. Since the coup, Honduras has become a narco state, propped up by increasing amounts of U.S. aid and instruments of repression. We have 9 military bases there. Public election, education, and health care were privatized. Labor and environment laws go unenforced. 2/3 of Hondurans have plunged into poverty. Hondurans don't care if Trump cuts off aid, rather. It only goes to line the pockets of corrupt officials to boost a representative military, a repressive military. If Trump wants them to stay home, then he should stop supporting dictators who repress the people while pampering foreign corporations. Hondurans couldn't elect the president they wanted, so now they're voting with their feet, and we should welcome them as refugees that they are.
8 years we bravely battled Bush, that smug, self-righteous frat boy on a bender.
Boy on a bender.
We marched against his endless war. We rallied every race and class and gender.
Every gender.
Our hearts were new, our states were blue, our aim was true, and yet we always missed him.
Too bad we missed him.
Perhaps our problem stemmed from our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system. Yeah. We caucused, called, and canvassed for Barack, raised cash and voter registration.
Registration.
Triumphantly we tuned into debate, acceptance speech, inauguration.
Inauguration.
Joe Biden felt he talked so well, and when Obama...
Good evening and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoy. The title of our show tonight is The Economy Blowing Bubbles. My guest is Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at University of Massachusetts at Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. Richard's groundbreaking work, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, inspired the creation of the nonprofit organization democracy at work. Good evening, Richard. How are you?
Very good, Michael, and glad to be talking with you.
Well, we're certainly happy to have you on here in Kansas City. The question in the title of our show is on the minds of many as the economy seems to be on the brink of an inevitable downturn. Perhaps a better question would be, why?
Well, you know, people are right to be nervous. It's the old joke. If you're not nervous about where the American economy is and where it's going, it probably means you're not paying attention. Everybody, left-wingers, right-wingers, and folks in the middle who pay attention are aware that, in the words of the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank in New York, which is the largest bank in the United States, a couple weeks ago they issued a report in which they not only say a downturn, a recession is coming, but they pinpoint the year 2020, early in that year, as when it will hit. And that's less than a year and a half from right now. So even the big bankers know it's coming. Let me explain what's going on. Capitalism is a very unstable system. Those of us who are professors of economics and who study the history of capitalism over the last three centuries that it has slowly become the global system it now is, quickly understand that literally wherever capitalism has settled in as the dominant system, starting in England in the 18th century and then spreading everywhere else, it has had one of these downturns every 4 to 7 years. That's the average. Well, if you count 4 to 7 from the last bad downturn, which was in 2008 and 2009, you can see that we're due for it. It's built into our system, despite every effort that countless leaders, for example, every American president has made to get us out of the crisis during his presidency, and often making a promise that not only if we follow his policies will he get us out of the crisis during his presidency, but his steps, his policies, will make sure our children don't suffer this in the future. Every president, at least since Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s, has made that promise. And no president has been able to keep the promise, which is why we're still now in the aftermath of the latest doozy, which went down in 2008 and 9. So many people are afraid that if the next one hits over the next 18 months, when we're barely out of the last one and millions of Americans are not, it's going to be another very bad scene, and that's what makes people, left, right, and center, very nervous.
Yeah. Richard, you know, you could describe our system as fatally flawed. And some would say that it's kind of built into it, you know. In other words, it's by design. It seems that only the fat cats, they seem to win each and every time when we see one of these fatal flaws strike our economy. And, of course, millions of other Americans really suffer some just hardship beyond reason. Go ahead.
It's not only true what you say. In a way, it's even more important to understand that there is something unspeakably irrational about these economic downturns that happen every 4 to 7 years, because nobody wants it. Think about this. The people who get unemployed, they don't want to be unemployed. They want a job and they want an income. The employer, he doesn't want to have to fire people. It doesn't make him feel good. It certainly doesn't improve his profitability to do that, to buy fewer inputs, to run his business at a lower level, to lay off people. So look what we have. We have a system in which everybody agrees that the economic downturn is bad, bad for business, bad for workers, bad for the community that can't raise taxes or even get the taxes it's used to because unemployed people don't pay the way they used to their taxes, the same for businesses. So that's the proof of the irrationality of capitalism, that it regularly reproduces something that every single person in the system recognizes as unwanted, unnecessary, wasteful, inefficient, you name it. I used to make a joke in my classes to my students at this point when I was explaining that, and I would lean across the podium and I would look at them and I would say, if you lived with a roommate as unstable as capitalism, you would have moved out long ago.
Indeed. You know, speaking of that, Richard, it kind of reminds me that, you know, capitalism has been a sacred cow in America. And many are considered un-American if we criticize it. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that's really the Cold War. You know, before the 1945, the end of World War II, before that, we had a pretty lively debate inside the United States. From much toward the end of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th, there were lots of people who voiced all kinds of criticisms of capitalism. We had a presidential candidate on the Socialist Party, Eugene Victor Debs, you know, who got millions of votes back at the beginning of the 20th century, and he was a critic of capitalism, and there were loads of others. It wasn't considered to be evil or bad. It was kind of the honest thing a society should actually welcome. You know, every economic system, not just capitalism, has had people who like it, who think it's good, and people who are critical and who think that the world could do better. And an honest and a healthy society welcomes that debate because, you know, the critics are the people who find the flaws. The critics are the people who identify problems. And that's what gives you progress. If you shut down, if you close off the critics, then there's an enormous danger, which we're living through here in America, that you don't face your problems and you don't face your flaws. And if you don't face them, it's very unlikely you're going to fix them. We've had the last 50, 60 years, most of that the so-called Cold War with Russia and all that, and it became, quote-unquote, unpatriotic to be critical. The exact opposite is the truth. The critics, by identifying and focusing us on the problems, at least give us the chance to fix them. And I think that we're doing ourselves no service at all by shutting them down.
Yep, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Richard. You know, invariably, we've got a system that, as I see it, certainly serves the so-called 1%. These guys never lose. Every time there's a downturn, every time there's a recession, every time there is a hiccup in our economy, these guys profit from it. Why do we take it?
Yes, it's a great question. And for me, the most dramatic example was the latest big crash in 2008. The same big bankers, the same big corporations, who used to enjoy giving speeches about how the government was inefficient and the government was a burden and private enterprise is the best thing since sliced bread. They all got on their private jets and flew to Washington to beg and plead with the government to bail them out, the government to save them, the government to rescue them. I thought it was the greatest exposure of hypocrisy I have ever seen. The only thing worse than that was to watch the politicians, whom these bankers had often put into office, fall all over themselves to give them the bailouts, to use public money to rescue them, to make no demands on them in return for being bailed out. It was like a spectacle in which the people who brought us the crisis got rewarded with government support rather than punished. It was extraordinary.
Yes.
And I think for most Americans, they see it. They just don't believe yet that there's anything they can do about it. And so they remind me of those stories about the deer in the headlights at night, that they're kind of frozen. They know this is bad for them. They know disaster is coming, but they're kind of frozen and haven't yet figured out what to do or how to do it to change the situation.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm reminded when Barack Obama took office, he publicly stated that he was going to take the keys to the bus away from those people who were driving Wall Street. And essentially, man, he appointed many of them to key positions in his administration. So I don't know. It seems that we need a psychiatrist more than an economist at times.
Well, you know, the power of big business in this country is enormous. And, you know, it takes an extraordinarily courageous politician. And not only that, it takes a politician who has a mass base, who has a significant base among the people, to go against them. But lest people, I don't want people to walk away from this or listening to this interview to get all down. Let me give you an example from American history when it went otherwise. And the example is the last great crash, 1929, the 1930s. Very different story. Not in terms of the collapse of capitalism, that was as worse even than the one we had in 2008. But what was very different was the reaction. Millions of Americans decided to join unions who had never done it before because they thought being in a union would get them through the Great Depression with less harm than if they didn't join. And hundreds of thousands of Americans joined two different socialist parties and a communist party. And the communists and the socialists and the unions, they worked together, and they went to the president of the United States, Roosevelt, who was neither a socialist nor a communist nor a union member, and they said to him, look, we put you in office. We're millions and millions of people, which they were. And if you want to stay in office as president, you've got to help us. You've got to do something for the average person going through this horrific capitalist breakdown that's none of our faults. And the president, because he was a good politician, he listened because this was millions of votes. He knew they were serious. And then, and this is what I want your listeners to understand, he did it. He delivered. Let me just very quickly go through it. 1933, in the middle of a depression when the government had no money, he created the Social Security system to do for the mass of people what those communists, socialists, and unionists had demanded. We never had a Social Security system before. With no money in the government's till, he committed to give every person 65 years of age or older a check every month for the rest of their lives. And before the ink dried on that, he created the unemployment compensation system. We never had that before in America either. If you lose your job, you get a check every week for half a year, or whatever. And then he created the first minimum wage so that employed people had a decent standard of living. And finally, he went on the radio, because there was no TV then yet, and he said, if the private sector will not give Americans the one thing they ask for, which is a job, then I, as the president, will do it. And between 1934 and 41, he hired 15 million Americans, giving them jobs like building the national parks in the West, conservation, artwork, and giving them an income so they didn't lose their homes and all the rest of it. And when people say to me, wow, he did all of that for the mass of people, I say yes. And then they look at me and they ask, well, where in the world did he get the money? Because it was a time of depression, so the taxes that the government was raising were very small. I said he decided to change the tax rates. And here's what he did. He went to corporations and the rich, and he hit them with enormous tax increases to pay for programs for the average American and for the poor. And so I say to them, you think that's not possible in American politics? It is possible, because we've already done that. We've been there. And the joke of it all is that the reaction of the American people to the one president who ever did that, tax corporations and the rich for the average person, they reelected Roosevelt three times. He was the most popular president in American history. We've never had anyone that popular before. We've never had anyone that popular since. So it turns out that if politicians have a little bit of a backbone and do what they know is right for the mass, for the majority of people, it doesn't destroy their political career. It actually makes it.
Indeed. Indeed. You're right, Richard. You know, it seems to me, and I think many would agree, that the right, the moneyed class in America, have been fighting to oppose the Roosevelt reforms since 1935. And certainly they've made a very successful attempt to turn those things around. You know, we as the public have kind of allowed it. You know, we just I think we're seeing an upsurge now or a resistance now. But certainly we've got a long way to go, man, because they've laid this framework for a good many years. Can you tell us about some of the things you've written about in your book, Democracy's Crisis Deepens? I've really been impressed with some of the worker self-directed enterprises that you've advocated.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I mean, the basic story is this. When the reforms were done by Roosevelt after the great crash of 1929 to 1941, we were sold a kind of bill of goods. I mean, we wanted to believe it, and so we did, that the reforms that they did then would somehow fix the problem, would somehow give the government the kind of control and regulation so that the business owners, the rich, would have to play by the rules that would prevent another great breakdown, another building of America as a country of inequality. We hoped we had done all of that. And the sad reality is that the business community, allied with the conservatives, have been rolling back, as you put it. They've rolled back the New Deal that Roosevelt put together literally in the last half century. And Trump is just the latest, most extreme version of that rollback. And I think there's a lesson here, and the lesson is you cannot regulate and control a capitalist system if you leave the big businesses in the hands of private capitalist interests. That what you're doing is you're leaving the people in control of the economy who have every incentive to undo the reforms you've put into place, to undo the regulations, because they can make more profits if they do. And that would be bad enough, but you go even further. You not only leave them with the incentive to undo your rules and regulations, but by allowing them to sit at the top of big corporations, you're allowing them to gather into their hands the resources, the profits every year that they can use as the means to realize the undoing of the rules and regulations. And that's exactly what they've done. So for those of us who see it and experience it and live it, the solution is kind of obvious. If you want the American economy to serve the American people, you've got to put the American people in charge. You cannot leave it in the hands of a small, rich minority who will continue to do what they have always done, which is make the system work for them. So what we advocate is a change in the organization of enterprises. Instead of a business being run by a very few people at the top, in a corporation, that's the board of directors and the major shareholders. In most cases, that's 20, 30, 40 people who get together and make all the decisions, even if the employees are 10,000 or 100,000. For us, that's not democratic. It's not the way it should be. If democracy is good for the communities where we live, it's likewise good for the communities where we work. Businesses should be run by workers, one person, one vote. And they should decide democratically what they produce, what technology to use, where the production should happen, and what is done with the profits that all of them help to produce.
Yes.
If you democratize the enterprise, which is the slogan that sums up what we're after, if you make enterprises run by the workers who live in them, then they will make decisions for the communities that they come from and are part of. You stop having an economy run by a tiny number of people at the top. Just a last point. the human race got rid of kings and queens and emperors and czars because we decided we didn't want one or two people at the top making all the decisions for us. That was part of the rationale of the American Revolution. Well, here's a simple thought. If kings and queens are not appropriate in the communities where we live, they're not appropriate in the communities where we work either.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't need it. And if we want a system that is not built to serve them, who are a minority, rather than the working people who are the majority, then we've got to change the organization of enterprises from the top-down hierarchical capitalist system to a system of worker co-ops or whatever you want to call them, democratically run enterprises, working out their relationships with one another and with the consuming public in a democratic way, which is what we've never had in this country, and which explains a lot of our problems.
Yes, absolutely. Richard, I wish I had scheduled a program for an hour, but unfortunately, we're at the end of our rope here. So we'll look forward to having you back on. We want to certainly thank you for sharing your insights with our listening community here at the Heartland Labor Forum. So with that, I'll say good evening to you.
In what's become an annual KKFI tradition, Lady D welcomes River Cow Orchestra back to the local showcase. River Cow Orchestra creates every performance in the moment. Listen to what eerie sounds may emanate from your radio tonight from 8 to 10.
The Kansas City chapter of American Promise will hold a workshop, Get Big Money Out of Politics, at the Westport Library on Saturday, October 27, from 2 to 4 p.m. American Promise is a national nonprofit advocating for a 20th Amendment to the Constitution, which would overrule the 2010 Supreme Court decision enshrining corporations as people and their political donations as free speech. This is a public service announcement of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Went into the post office, I wanted to buy stamps. Went into the post office and I asked the postal clerk if he would give me $10 worth of commems. When I buy stamps, I like to buy commemorative stamps because they make a statement to the people that you're sending that letter to. Tells these people that you're somebody who has a real class, you know. It's not like those little wimpy stamps that you buy in the books. Got the birds on there and insects and flowers and sometimes the American flag, you know. Those things are great, but they don't make the statement that a commemorative makes. So I said to the postal clerk, I'd like to have $10 worth of commems, and he handed me a sheet of stamps that had the countenance of a black man on there, a man by the name of A. Philip Randolph. And I said to the postal clerk, you know, it's high time that they put a working person's picture on a postage stamp. He says to me, do you know who that is? And I said, sure, that's A. Philip Randolph. He was the president of the Sleeping Car Porters Union. And the postal clerk thanked me. And he said people had been asking him who that was, and now he'd be able to tell them. But a lot of things have changed about the railroads, you know. Philip Randolph is gone, and the Sleeping Car Porters Union is gone, and the porters are gone, and those heavyweight sleeping cars, you know, the kind that you and I know, they're gone too. And another thing that's disappearing from the railroad is the caboose. The railroad learned that they could get rid of three more people if they took the caboose off the end of the train. And as soon as they can figure out how to get rid of, to run the train without an engineer, they're going to do that too. But
won't be much of a train, will it?
Well, it won't have an engineer, that's for sure. But still be a train, I guess. What they have in place of the caboose is a computer that goes onto the last car. It clamps into the coupler there. It has a red light on it. It blinks on and off, and it monitors the air pressure. And It keeps the engineer informed of his air pressure through a readout up in the cab. I sang this song for an old-timer that worked for the Santa Fe, and he said to me, on a Santa Fe, we call those Freds. And of course, I did not know what that was an acronym for. But it had something to do with a rear-end device. So, at any rate, when Fred falls off and smashes on the ballast, the engineer and the conductor, they'll go running back there. Oh, Fred! Oh, Fred, get up, Fred! Fred, speak to us! But Fred does not get up, and he does not speak. He told me one day they're going over a bridge, and Fred rattled off, bounced over the side of the bridge down into the river below, and it's floating away, and the red light is still flashing on and off. And, swim, Fred, swim! Tells me that sometimes people shoot at Fred, and I believe that. He's not paying any union dues, you know. But I've been collecting Fred stories. I've been singing this song for some time now, and the collection grows and grows. And I'll make this promise to you that if you can get me an end of train device, a story that I'm honest enough to admit that I've never heard before, I'll buy the pork chops. But this latest one was sent to me by Cuddy over there. And he says, freight train without a caboose. Doesn't that remind you of those gowns you get when you check into the hospital? Something's missing from the modern ways. These'll never be the good old days. You can hardly find a smiling face on an end of train device. I'd like to take my little grandson down to where a young boy's dreams were found, but I couldn't show him any romance round an end of train.
And of course, that was the great railroad singer Larry Penn, and I'm Judy Ansel. And with me in the studio, I have three railway workers who are probably too young to remember the end of train device or the caboose. Now, some of the first unions in America were, of course, railroad unions. Some of them had names you've never heard of. A quick trip to Wikipedia yields some like the Steam Railroad Men's Protective Union, the Colored Trainmen of America, and the Grand International Union of Locomotive Firemen, the Yardmasters, and of course the Knights of Labor. All of those I mentioned are either defunct or merged long ago into something much bigger. Most of the old unions were brotherhoods. Draw your own conclusions and add white before brother. What's also true for most of them is that they were exclusive, either by craft. After all, what do railway yardmen have in common with sleeping car porters? Or they were exclusive by race and gender. Throughout their long history, rail unions have been divided, and throughout that history, there have been rail workers who have tried to get them together into one big rail union, or at least to bargain together so they don't get pitted against each other. So the struggle goes on, and a fresh crop of young activists are here in the studio to talk about what's called the All Craft Coalition. So welcome to the show. First off, Morty, otherwise known as Charles Mortensen, a member of the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way. We'll find out what that is in a minute. And Aaron Dixon, a member of the International Association of Machinists. And Adam Hoslag, a member of the IBEW. So let's start with you, Maury. Tell us who your union represents and what your members do.
The Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way, the BMWD, we are track guys. We maintain and repair the tracks and bridges and buildings for the railroad and make sure the trains can pass safely over the rails.
So I live near the Santa Fe, and so I probably see you when I drive down Metropolitan and I see guys working on the track. That's your members?
Yes, I spend many hours in that yard.
All right. Aaron, how about you? What do your members do?
We work in the locomotive shop. We work on the engines. We do everything from repairing the engine itself to the cab to the traction motors and all the safety devices therefore.
Okay. And you work for the UP, right?
I do.
Union Pacific. And you do too, Adam, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what kind of jobs do IBEW members do there?
We handle all the electrical components, safety components, everything that happens on the train is mostly electrical and computer, and that's what we maintain and inspect, make sure it's in good working order.
Okay, what other unions represent people who work for the railroad? Just give us a sampling.
You have SMART-TD, which used to be UTU. You have the BLET, which they're a division of the Teamsters.
And that's the locomotive engineers?
Yes.
Okay.
And then you have the BRS, the Brotherhood of Signalmen. You have the TCU, which are the carmen.
Which are under the IAM umbrella.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the older, like the IAM and the Teamsters have absorbed a number of these unions, right?
Yeah, the BLET and the BMWD are all a division of the
Teamsters. So you're a Teamster?
Yep, that is correct.
Okay. What else?
Sheet metal workers.
Yeah.
That's SMART, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. Is that of all of them or are there more?
NCFO, the laborers, firemen, oilers, the laborers in the shop. And I believe they used to be in the car shop. And actually,
what does a fireman do on the railroad anymore? They're not steam.
They're just a laborer.
They call them MSOs now, yeah. Maintenance Service Operator.
Uh-huh. Wow. And so do they still have conductors?
Yes.
Yeah.
What do those guys do?
The conductors, they're in charge of the train and the cars itself. So if they got a broken knuckle or anything like that, they're supposed to go out and replace the knuckle.
What's a knuckle?
Where the couples, the two cars come together.
Oh, okay. Yeah, watch the jargon.
Yeah. And then you have an engineer, and he's in charge of the engine itself. So
okay, we're going to get to the engineers later because what Larry Penn was saying is actually come to pass. They want to get rid of those guys, right? So, okay. So are railroad jobs good jobs? Who wants that?
I would say that it used to be, and as time goes on, the worse and worse it gets. You know, I got 13 years on the railroad, and when I first started, my wife didn't have to work or anything like that. And now with the, you know, cost of living has gone up so high, my wife has to work. We can't make it without her working.
Uh-huh. So. And, of course, there's notorious health and safety issues.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. How many railroaders died last year on the job?
Railroaders, I think there's about 22. And then with the public, like I was telling you earlier, there was 888 deaths, you know, including the public.
Dangerous instruments, those railroads, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So there's a lot of railroad jobs in the Kansas City area, aren't there? Are they growing or are they laying off people?
They're growing. I mean, Kansas City is the second largest rail hub in the country, second to Chicago. And you have about almost every railroad, major railroad, comes through Kansas City. So. And they're growing. I mean, I think majority of the shops around town are hiring. So.
Okay, but didn't I just hear about some layoffs?
Well, the problem is that the majority of the railroads cannot get trained people to come on and sign on as journeymen. So they're offering extravagant signing bonuses of $25,000 just to come and work for them.
Wow. Hey, everybody, get yourselves down there, right? Go find a job. Get the skills, though, first, right?
Right.
Okay, so what's wrong with your current multi-craft, multi-union bargaining structure and structure for the union?
Well, the problem is what's going on, and this has gone on for hundreds of years, is there's currently now 13 different unions. And when we negotiate with the big seven, like BNSF and UP and them, they all come together as one to negotiate to, you know, screw us on our contract. But the unions, they are all divided up in coalitions, and they divide us. So, and what ends up, happens is one breaks away to, you know, their rules or something like that with one-man train crews, which we're going to talk about later, and they sign a deal, and once one sign that, they call that the pattern of bargaining. And then we all get stuck with what they sign.
So they find the weakest link, they bargain the weakest contract for the workers, and then they shove it down the throats of everybody else.
That is correct.
Yeah, they target the people that have the most to lose as far as work rules that would eliminate jobs, and they dangle the contract.
So they feel the most threatened.
Yes. Yeah, right.
And then they dangle something in front of them, they buy it.
Right.
And, I mean, your union leaders must understand that this is going on, right?
You would think, yeah.
You know, in the over 150 years the railroads have been in existence, the one thing that's never happened is all the unions have united and bargained together. That's never happened. All the shop crafts have bargained together in a uh-huh. collective, and the operating crafts have, but not all the war workers.
All of them all together. Yeah. And, of course, there have been many attempts to bring railroad workers together. Probably the most famous was Eugene Debs and the American Railway Union back in the 1890s, which got smashed not just by the railroads but by the federal government. So it seems like maybe people don't want you to get together, you think?
Yeah, the railroad has a lot of money.
The railroads have a lot of money.
They spend a lot of money keeping us separated.
Yeah, okay, all right. So, I mean, what do you think could be better in your contracts that you don't get because of this disunity?
I mean, with our contracts currently with us, and I speak for Adam and Aaron as well, is our insurance. We work for a multi-billion dollar company.
You work for the Santa Fe, so.
Yeah,
Burning,
I mean, but, I mean, and UP is just as equally as rich as BNSF, but, you know, we are exposed to a lot of dangers. We have the ties are full of creosote. We have tank cars that are going by us. We have no clue what are in them. So we need our insurance. And, you know, my 13 years on the railroad, I know 8 people personally that have died doing this job, whether it was doing the job or having a stroke or heart attack afterwards. So our insurance is very important to us.
And they're trying to make it worse?
Yes, and they continue to make it worse.
When I started 13 years ago, the insurance was completely paid for. It cost zero cost to the membership.
And what is it now?
It's $228.98 a month.
You're paying that out of pocket?
Yeah, and then with our current situation, with our last round of negotiations, our out of pocket when we go see a doctor and everything is doubled.
Wow. So that's a significant loss, obviously.
Yes.
So it's concessionary bargaining you're doing.
Correct.
Okay, so this effort, I know that the All Railcraft Coalition, it has a limited goal, is that right, of bringing you together just around contract negotiations?
No, not that. I mean, they're constantly messing with all the crafts all the time and trying to change work rules whenever they think they could do it. And we're just trying to get 13 different crafts in the same room and start a grassroots movement and start supporting each other and understanding our issues, because like a lot of the trainmen don't understand our issues and we don't know their issues. We think we know their issues, but you get a lot of them that come in and they throw something at us that we never even thought of they'd have an issue with, and then just start a grassroots movement, because I mean the main thing is we do the work, we have the numbers, and this railroad's not worth a dime if we all sit down. So, and that's going to take all 13 of us to come together and start doing this together as one.
So how many have joined so far?
At the All Craft Coalitions, we've had as little as 8 and as big as 109 people show up.
From how many different crafts?
We had, normally it's about 5 or 6 crafts show up, but our biggest one we had all 13 crafts.
Really?
In the room. Yeah.
So you're making some progress. You must be a threat.
So
what's the difference between the All Railcraft Coalition and Railway Workers United?
Well, the ARC, we call it, the All Railcraft Coalition, it's basically boots on the ground. I mean, we're doing local meetings.
Uh-huh.
The Maintenance Away has been instrumental in going around the country and organizing meetings and bringing people together and making them aware of the situation. RWU, which I'm a member of, started under, I think, 08 on the BN, tried to push one-man train crews through. And that's where it came from, out of the operating crafts.
Mm-hmm.
And it spread into legal defense and educating members and united bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the same.
So are
things.
These two groups working together? You're a member of both, right?
Yes.
So.
Yes. I mean, we help one another quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, you know, in the future what's going to happen with the two groups. You know, I personally would like to see the two groups merge. To become one and become a stronger force, because the Railroad Workers United has a majority of operating craft people. They're getting more shop craft people all the time and non-operating craft. So, I mean, the potential's there to really build a strong movement.
And ARC is more of the non-operating people. Is that right?
No, it's a majority of all. I mean, the main thing with RWU is their main push is trying to create one big union, and ours is just trying to get all 13 crafts together to negotiate as one.
So two different tactics, and we'll see.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll achieve some unity, which would be great. So we don't have much time left. I just want to ask you about this threat of one-man crews. One of you said before we went on the air that this is the next big struggle. So who wants to talk about it?
Most definitely. I think it is the next big struggle. And, you know, a lot of people feel sold out on this last round of negotiations because the operating crafts signed the contract first and established a pattern of bargaining, which we get stuck with. The thing is people need to realize in the rail industry that the one thing that really ties us together is our retirement. It's funded by ourselves. I mean, we fund our retirement. Uh-huh. Social Security was based off of railroad retirement.
Uh-huh.
And the less people paying into it, what's that do to our retirement plan? We need to be aware of this, and we need to be fighting not only for our retirement, but for safety. That Lac-Mégantic tragedy in Canada was a one-man crew.
Right.
You know, and it was a tragedy.
And it destroyed a whole town.
Yes. Yeah. It killed, I think, almost 80 people.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yes. You know, and those are the kind of threats that could happen in this country. People just need to be aware of it.
Okay, and one of the things that I think you mentioned to me, Morty, in the past was that states could ban the one-man crew. Is that
yes,
right?
And we're trying to do that currently, make it law when you come through the state of Missouri that you have to have two-man train crews. They've done it in Washington, and they got a couple other states. I'm not – California is another one. But the thing is, like, California's law, the fines are very – very minimum, you know. They're very small.
It's like oversized trucks, probably.
Yeah.
So, how soon do you think they're going to try to implement this?
The one-man train crews. It's coming. 2020 is when our next round of negotiations. So, I can't predict the future, but I can guarantee you that that's probably one of their main things that are going to be on the table.
In the new climate of railroading, with this precision railroading, CSX has done it. UP just started doing it. I mean, it's all about making the profits from within, cutting their overhead, cutting the bottom line. And I mean, that's an obvious way to do it, is eliminate, you know, half the operating crafts.
Sure. Well, okay, go ahead, and then we're
also outside. They spent millions of dollars with positive train control, which gives the railroads the ability to control the trains from a back office server, and they can stop them, sound the horn, do all this stuff. It just hasn't – they don't have all the bugs worked out of it yet. So once that goes online, it's really going to be tough.
Whoa, scary. Okay. Well, we've been talking to – that was Adam Haslag from IBEW, Aaron Dixon from The Machinist, and Charles Mortensen, or Morty, from the BMWE. And thank you guys very much. We'll have to have you back on as this progresses.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks,
Judy.
Hi, and that music means that we're going to talk to Mark Grunberg for Washington Window on Workers and find out what's going on in the big capital. Mark, I know you're writing a lot about the upcoming elections and what to expect. So what do you have to say that nobody else has said?
What I have to say is that everything, with 2 weeks to go, everything is still very much up for grabs. We have a blue wave that started on January 21st, the day after Trump got inaugurated, 2017.
Uh-huh.
We have a red wave that started when Trump and Mitch McConnell pushed Matt Kavanaugh onto the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
We have workers trying to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, look at the economy, look at health care, look at all these things that the ruling Republicans have done to you, and vote accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have record numbers of women and minority candidates running nationwide, everywhere from Missouri to Kansas to Arizona to California to you name it.
Mm-hmm.
all of this is a real I wouldn't call it a witch's brew, but it's a real crazy brew of everything. And then throw these pipe bombs on top of all of it, and you have a real mess going into these last 10 days.
So I take it you're not going to make any predictions, huh?
I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb and say that the Democrats will narrowly take the House.
All right. We're going to hold you to that.
I don't think they'll take the Senate, and I'm not even going to try and predict either the Kansas governor's race or the Missouri Senate race, because both are too close to call. So,
well, one of the things that they're talking about is whether or not the Republicans get a big bump because of the economy and the tax cuts. What do you think?
The answer is no, because what people have realized, and the Republicans aren't even talking about the tax cut on the campaign trail, is that people have realized this is a tax cut for the 1% and corporations, and people don't like that. That's why Trump jumped in the other day with this brainstorm of his 10% cut for the middle class. Of course, there's no details on his brainstorm.
Right, but they're also going to get hit real quick with the enormously growing deficit, right?
Exactly. You get an enormously growing deficit, and all the money is going into the pockets of the 1%, and people know it.
Yeah.
So as a result, the Republicans are running on everything but the tax cut, if you will.
Okay, we just have a couple more minutes, but I want to ask you about a story you have in this week's news that is not on this topic. It's about Donald Trump's favorite union suing Donald Trump. Tell us about that.
This is the union that represents the ICE agents down on the border. And what Donald Trump's Office of Management and Budget did was tell their boss, their Department of Homeland Security, to, in so many words, cut their overtime. Now, mind you, when you're in a Jeep on the border patrolling, you're not going to work a 9-to-5 day. It's going to be however long you need to get to patrol the border. So they racked up a lot of overtime over the years.
So this is Border Patrol, not ICE.
Yeah. Both, as a matter of fact. But it's mostly, it is Border Patrol, now that I think of it. Thank you.
Okay.
So the result is that the Office of Personnel Management wants to change the way to calculate that overtime in a way that, in so many words, would produce a pay cut
for
5,000 agents on the border.
So they're suing Trump. That's kind of ironic, since
they supported him
for president. Yeah. Okay, well, we're out of time. Next month, we're going to hold you to your predictions on the elections, okay?
Yes, it'll be interesting, to say the least. So.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye-bye. And now for the calendar. And we're going to make it quick because we're just about out of time. So there's a debate watch party going on starting at 8 o'clock this evening, watching the senatorial debate between McCaskill and Hawley. And that's at Californo's downstairs. Canvas Saturdays or Sundays with Jobs with Justice. This weekend, if you want to canvas Saturday, go to their office at 87th and Troost at 11 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning. And Sunday, go to SEIU at 4501 Paseo from 2 to 5 p.m. And then next week, we'll have new times. Volunteer to help do election protection. There's a training, 9:30 a.m. Saturday, at Southeast Community Center, 4201 East 63rd Street. And that's being promoted by the labor movement and the NAACP. And Trans Lives Matter demonstration, Saturday, October 27th, 2 to 3 p.m. at the J.C. Nichols Fountain. That's it. You can find the rest of our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can find our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're going to be talking about the ballot initiatives Clean and Raise Up Missouri. That's Amendment 1 and Proposition B. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. And here's Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. To struggle